like Sarah was just mentioning, I'm barely getting back from this trip to Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. Really just kind of just beginning to sift through all the different experiences that I had there. So please forgive any incoherence right now. I'm still even slightly jet lagged. I've been getting up at 3:30 in the morning, and not because of an infant, which is part of the reason. But it's great to be here, and let me just I want to say it's great to be back in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, and I'm just honored to be a part of this convergence here. So I want to begin by telling you how I ended up going on this trip with Gabe Scavone, as Sarah mentioned. And it began a number of years ago when I was doing research on the U.S.-Mexico border. And I was looking at the kind of massive buildup that we've seen here on the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, over the last 25 years, we've seen annual budgets go from, $1.5 billion to $18 billion. That's a 12-fold increase over the last 12 years. So when you hear people saying, oh, there's nothing on the border, well, Border Patrol over the last 25 years has increased from 4,000 agents to about 22,000 now. Customs and Border Protection is the largest federal law enforcement agency at 60,000. It not only includes the Border Patrol, but they have Air and Marine Division, so basically an Air Force and a Navy, as well as Special Forces units, almost like a domestic army. And along with these kind of massive budget increases, there have been increasing participation of the private sector, right? So I began to look at, well, is there a developing industrial complex on U.S.-Mexico border? One of the places I began to look was the University of Arizona here up in Tucson. University of Arizona, I believe it was 2008, was awarded a grant from the Department of Homeland Security to be the lead university in what was called a center of excellence. It's a center of excellence, a lead university in research and development about border, creating border technologies. Attached to that, so what that means is you have engineers in the University of Arizona like looking at studying locust wings and trying to develop miniature drones equipped with cameras that may patrol the border here. One part of that was that there's a science and technology park that's attached to it. So I went and interviewed the CEO of the technology park. And when I was interviewing the CEO, he said, well, you know, you have we have in Southern Arizona identified 57 companies private companies who are working on border security. In other words, we have the largest cluster of private companies in North America, in Southern Arizona. We want to build on that. The line is, we want to build on that. It's going to create jobs. It's a part of the big tech industry. So I asked him, okay, you said the biggest cluster in North America. Is there a bigger cluster than 57 companies concentrated on border security? And what did he answer?
Israel.
Israel by far is number one, the number one area where developing security tech companies. And so from that point on, the next time I wanted to mention too, one of the reasons I was talking to him is if you look at the market, the border security market, for example, it's one of the last forecasts I saw put it in an unprecedented boom period. In 2013, it was a $20 billion industry. If you take Homeland Security in the global sense, it's projected to be in 2018, $544 billion globally. Some people say Mexico will pay for it.
Only one
Only one person says that. Yeah. One example of the like that market, the video surveillance is $12 billion in 2012. In 2020, it's projected to be $40 billion. So that's triple. You know, you're looking at a kind of the unprecedented boom period. This is an industry that people are looking into, investing in, and that sort of thing. And that's kind of driving, you know, the tech park. So the next time I went to see the CEO of the tech park, they had a new program that they were beginning to implement, and it was called the Israel Business Initiative. And it was part of a bigger international program called Global Advantage. And the idea was to attract Israeli companies to Southern Arizona, particularly border security companies. And I'll get into that in a second. But I want to look at why Israel. So you're probably wondering, this is not a very clear picture of. I have some images, and that's. I'm sorry, my PowerPoint is a little bit pathetic, but I have a couple images. That image you probably can't even see. Is there any way to clear this?
Yeah.
To focus this? Does anyone know how to do this?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
That's as clear as
we can.
All right.
Yeah, the lights, it's a little bit better. So mentioned before, I was just in Israel, Palestine. I left. By the way, I was in Jordan too. And just as an aside, I'm working on a bigger book project that's looking at the kind of externalization of the U.S. border model. And so the reason I was in Jordan is because the United States is pouring. They have $500 million. And they're pouring into the Jordanian border. So I went up to the Jordanian border with Syria, and Raytheon of Tucson is the primary contractor. So that's just an aside. But my first day in Israel, I went to Unmanned Systems conference, and this is where this picture is. And the first thing when I got dropped off with by the taxi that I saw was this, and it probably looks, it's kind of still blurry a little bit, but it kind of looks like a tank or something. It's an unmanned ground vehicle. It's called Row Battle. Unmanned ground vehicles, the one, not this one, but another one developed by Elbit Systems, and we'll talk a little bit more about Elbit Systems here in a minute. Is now patrolling the border on the enclosure wall, along the enclosure wall with Gaza. So this is kind of a new, this is an idea, this is an example of the kind of new robots patrolling the border, so to speak. And that was kind of the first thing that I saw. Still, I don't know if you can see in this photo, but this is a look at the conference. You can see lots of people milling about. Again, it's unmanned surveillance systems, so there's a lot of drones, flying drones, boats, other vehicles, little robots, that sort of thing.
Can you step to your side a little bit?
I can't, actually. There's no room. Anyhow, that's what this conference was put on by a company called Israeli Homeland Security, and it's actually an accelerator, an incubator, and there's no other. I interviewed the CEO of the Israel IHLS, they call it Israeli Homeland Security. And he said, at any given time, there's 7,000 to 8,000 startup companies in Israel in the security tech industry, which is quite a bit. And just in Tel Aviv alone, there's 600 startups created every year. And if you look since 9/11, the security industry, as far as profits made by Israel, have gone up from $2 to $7 billion. So it's been quite an area of a lot of focus.
So that's all U.S. money?
No, it's not all U.S. money. There is, you know, the U.S. military assistance goes in. I think it goes to 25% of Israeli companies, and I believe it will go into some of the research and development. It's highly, highly subsidized by Israel's government. So, here's another technology. They're showing a presentation. I actually wanted to see if I could. Actually, I'm not going to be able to do it. I was going to play a recording that I made outside of the convention hall. There were demonstrations of the technologies, and it was like there was a kind of sportscaster, and he was like, "Look at this. This is called a Dogo robot. This Dogo robot weighs 12 kilograms. You can put it in a briefcase. Then you can put it down." And you can see this gentleman is putting in a 9mm Glock into this small robot. And this robot then would go around, and you could actually see the barrel of the Glock, and it was pointing at everyone. But that's the kind of, technologies and how it's being pitched to the world. Mind you, that was in English, it wasn't in Hebrew. And that's another picture of the Dogo. You can barely see it, but it's called the Orbiter drone, and it was flying overhead as we stood there watching, and they said, "Well, this drone could fly around and get 2.5 hours and get intelligence for those 2.5 hours, and then it could do a suicide mission after that." So they're suicide drones. The idea is that it becomes a missile, right? In a very similar sort of technology show conference that I went to in El Paso in 2012, there was an Israeli brigadier general there, and he had kind of explained, probably put it in the best terms, why Israel is such a place where such technologies are developed. And he said, "We have learned lots from Gaza. It is a great laboratory." So the idea that there's a perpetual conflict and that technologies can be tested out and then showcased to the world is very much a part of this kind of export industry. But it's not only weapons. I don't know if people are familiar with the anthropologist Jeff Helper.
Yeah. Yeah.
He wrote this book,
yeah.
War Against the People.
Yeah,
yeah. Highly recommended this book.
War
Against the People. Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification is the title. In that book, Helper, it's not only weapons, it's a matrix of control that he talks about. He talks about the kind of what I would say border building that we are very familiar here in Southern Arizona, the electronic fences, the watchtowers, the sniper posts, the surveillance cameras, the electronic surveillance, the heavily militarized lines of division that separate people, that exclude certain people and give access to other people. That's the kind of thing what Helper says. Israel is not only selling individual technologies and weapons, it's selling a model of a security state. One example I had when I was there is I met with a family. Oh, this is what you see from the drone, like the kind of monitor. You could look overhead and see. That's Kalandia, if anybody's been to that checkpoint. Those are the kind of cages you have to walk into, and then eventually you'll be questioned by soldiers. That's a sign when you're going into Area A, when you're going into areas that are administered by the Palestinian Authority. And it says, this road to Area A under the Palestinian Authority, the entrance for Israeli citizens is forbidden, dangerous to your lives, and is against the Israeli law. I thought it was similar to some of the signs we see out here in the desert. There's very, very different variations of the signs, but this one's a common one, where this kind of fear narrative that's constantly reinforced. This is the separation wall, or one of the places in the separation wall in East Jerusalem. The next picture is, actually, where we're driving by, we saw a guy climbing over it. You see the guy up on the top? So he's coming from the other side of, in East Jerusalem. And I'm getting to this. This is the house. This is the separation wall on either side of this house. And you can barely see at the end, there's a gate. There's one single house on the end of that, right there, this man and his children. And the separation wall literally comes all the way around his house, and then he has to go along that gate, that kind of hallway or that gate. And this is an electrified fence, wow. Right? He's not allowed, he or his family is not allowed to go on the other side. They're just not allowed. They don't have the documents to do so. They don't have the license plate to get on the road to be able to do so. And if they dare to climb this fence, it's electric. And surrounding them is a settlement. So it's so close that when we stepped out of the house, you could smell people they're cooking. You can smell people's cooking, so it's very close. That's another view of the house that you can see right here. You can probably barely see it, but it says across this line, this is the line that separates this house. This is in the settlement, but he says if you cross this line, it's a danger to your life because it's a military zone, implying that you might be shot, right? So this is that kind of like infrastructure of what I would call a homeland security state or security state, you know, is this is what, according to Halper and many others, is one of the things that Israel is selling to the world. And that's where we'll get to, to continue with the University of Arizona, if you look, the Israeli Business Initiative, it wants to attract, I mean, companies from Israel from many different sectors, but one of the huge ones is security. And so like those companies like Dago with the robot, that unmanned ground vehicle, the suicide drone, they're trying to attract companies like that to set up in Southern Arizona, right? And so the idea is that they'll facilitate the arrival of these companies. You know, like how normal people have so much trouble crossing international boundary lines? Well, in this case, they're saying, well, we'll like help you through all those processes. We'll facilitate, we'll get you landed in Southern Arizona. And then not only that, we'll set you up with a manufacturing base in guess where?
Guaymas,
Mexico. Mexico, so maquila workers in Mexico will be producing technologies from companies from Israel that will then be deployed on the U.S.-Mexico border and possibly be used against the very workers who made those products. That's the kind of like supply chain sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, that's being developed around this homeland security industry. And one of the examples of this, and I'm not sure where Elbit Systems is manufacturing its products yet, but I'm assuming many people are familiar with Elbit Systems here in this room, being that they are one of the biggest Israeli companies. I think there's 12,000 employees. They have subsidiaries all over the world. They just got a big contract with Brazil here, for example. And they got a big contract on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2014. They also were, according to some, if you talk to Glenn Spencer, if anyone's familiar with Glenn Spencer from the American Border Patrol, he says that he flew the first drone on the U.S.-Mexico border but other reports say that Elbit Systems, the Hermes drones from Elbit Systems, were the first to fly and patrol the U.S.-Mexico border in 2004. Yes, ma'am.
When you talk about the U.S.-Mexico border, are you talking about the Rio Grande River as well as the Arizona Desert, or just the land portion of the border?
Right now, I'm talking more Arizona, because
yeah,
that's where Elbit's focused.
Is this stuff going on all along the Rio Grande River?
Yeah, let me, I'll talk a little bit to that in a second. Right now, what Elbit Systems got a contract to do was just Arizona. So I believe it's 52 surveillance tower, or 52 towers, which are called integrated fixed towers. And this is important to consider, because integrated fixed towers mean they're not singular towers. They're actually towers that are working in tandem with other towers, right? So it's this kind of matrix of control. You could see similarities to the matrix of control that coming from Israel. I want to show one thing.
A lot of those surveillance towers are non-functional now, correct? I've seen several of them.
Supposedly the seven, there's seven been constructed in Nogales, and those seven are supposed to be functional.
The ones I saw around Arawak are non-functional.
Those are from the SBI net, which is the previous program that was actually discontinued by Department of Homeland Security. Boeing Corporation had the contract for that one, and then it was canceled, and then the contracts were reissued, and in 2014, Elbit Systems of America, their U.S. subsidiary, got the contract, and it was like $150 million to start, but up to $1 billion, 52 total towers. I wanted to show this. I was going to show this whole video here, because this is when they were promoting the towers, right? But I don't know if you can see, but this idea of using the occupied territories in Palestine as a laboratory and then selling the product as combat proven. That's what is going on. So if you look here, field proven architecture, and you see the tower, and then you say 10 plus years securing the world's most challenging borders. And those are the borders right within Israel or around Israel. And so that's how Elbit Systems was marketing the tower program. There's a number of companies going for it, and they were awarded the contract. And so they have built the first seven towers. And the idea, the best way I would like look at the Elbit Systems towers is as a virtual wall, right? So the idea of one tower will have all kinds of cameras hanging, radar, night vision cameras that can see 7 miles away. And attached to these towers are operational control rooms. These operational control rooms will be connected to the motion sensors. And mind you, along the U.S.-Mexico border, there are 12,000 implanted motion sensors. So if people trip the motion sensor, it'll beep in this operational control room. The feeds from the drones, the unmanned aerial systems, the Predator bees that are flying overhead, probably flying over this very hotel as we speak, those feeds go into this operational control room. Also from the cameras from the different towers, and agents kind of sit there looking at monitors. And it's kind of robotization of the border, really. And that's what's this idea of a virtual wall across Arizona. And it's alongside all the other kind of big bolstering that we've seen on the U.S.-Mexico border. But
you had said the first project had been canceled.
Yeah.
Can you tell us why?
So it was Boeing Corporation. They were, I think, what was it called? SBINet. It was called SBINet, Secure Border Initiative. They were giving a project that was supposed to be more all-inclusive, right? They were in charge of not only the towers, but they would be in charge of, you know, a number of different things. And what they've done, they said that, well, the towers would detect, you know, rain would fall, and they think there was human beings. You know, it wasn't they weren't geared for the kind of rugged terrain that we have on the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, that sort of thing. It wasn't cost effective. It was too expensive, and so that was canceled. And by the way, the seven towers passed its the pilot period. So now they were going to begin to construct on the Tonanto Nation next. But what I've heard, I don't know if you've heard otherwise. I've heard that they're actually constructing in Douglas.
Well, because there's so many issues with the towers.
Yeah.
One of the districts is really opposed that they were supposed to go into. And like you're saying, they're integrated. So, you know, like they have to have all of them, you know, according to them.
Yeah.
For that, you know, like that virtual wall. So they're...
So it's delayed on
It's delayed.
They want to still do it, right?
Yeah,
but it's delayed.
Yeah, it was supposed to go in this past summer, construction.
Right.
But, you know, it's just been delayed so many times.
So I hear that the towers now are, the next phase is in around Douglas. So it's, the idea is that section by section by section, there will be 52 towers built along the U.S.-Mexico border, inland, mind you, inland. They're not on the border, they're 12, 15 miles inland. Yes, sir.
Just to make clear what Halford describes as the underlying thinking behind what you're describing is for non-conventional warfare, the United States used to do counterinsurgency, which depended upon persuading a population that we were going to give them what they wanted. No longer doing that. Now what we're doing and what Israel is doing is figuring out how to deal with the population when the population knows and we know that we are never going to give them what they need or want, and how do you control them? It's what we're doing on the border, and it's why the occupation is necessary to Israel's economy. They will never end the occupation, because that's how Israel makes its living, by finding methods of controlling a population that knows it will never get what it wants.
Thanks,
sir.
Do you?
So I live on the U.S.-Mexico border, south of Bisbee, a little closer to Bisbee than Douglas. And I understand that billionaire Warren Buffett is a major investor in Elbit Systems. Warren Buffett's son, Howard Buffett, in 2014 just bought several thousand acres, 4 miles down the road from me. At the same time, this series of watchtowers, one of them overlooks my property, started to go up, lots of vehicles, nice concrete pallets on the road going up to the tower. Again, this is all surrounding my property on the border. Could you comment on that? Do you know anything about that? At the same time, I will mention, because you mentioned the control rooms. So Howard Buffett bought a four-room adobe house about 4 miles down the road from me. That now has a helipad. They built a whole compound on it, and they are super secretive. When you drive by there, they have guards, chain link fencing gone up. I've done some videotaping around my property when this huge tower was going up. Got a visit 2 days later from the sheriff of Cochise County, who you can look up online. This is Sheriff Mark Daniels, and Howard Buffett has given nearly $27 million to the Cochise County Sheriff's Department. I don't know anything about that.
That's the only thing I know. That's sheriff. I know that he's connected with the Sheriff's Department. I did read an article about that. About the other stuff, I have no idea. It seems, unless he's like donating to the federal government, it's the federal government building these surveillance towers through, and the one we were just discussing is Elbit. I don't know if they're Elbit Systems towers or not, but unless it's like private towers on private land, which I don't know anything about, I would assume any tower going up is built by the federal government, and probably right now in Arizona would be through Elbit Systems. But what the question is, what is the purpose of building them 12 miles in, which is a really good question, because now we're now we're going to the nature of what border policing is, right? Like, border, is the border policing just on the border? No, right? So what the official jurisdiction of the U.S. Border Patrol is 100 miles from the actual border inland. So if you can imagine the contour of the United States, the 2,000 mile southern border, the 4,000 mile Canadian border, the coasts, and just imagine like an, or I bet some of you have seen the ACLU. ACLU has done a map, but you can imagine like a band around it. That's 100, that's a so-called 100 mile zone, what the ACLU calls a constitution free zone, right? So in those 100 miles, which cover two-thirds of the U.S. population, about 200 million people, right? That's where Border Patrol can operate. So they can put up their, right now, if you look at the 2012 to 2016 strategy, they say the international border is no longer the first nor last not line of defense. That's how they put it, first nor last line. So it's the militaristic language is there, line of defense against Mexico. We're at war with Mexico. What's going on here, right? But the idea is there's layers. And one of the layers is the virtual wall, or the kind of like surveillance layer that those towers represent, 12, 15 miles inland. You go another 10 miles, 15 miles, you get the checkpoints, right? Layers of checkpoints. And then, the roving patrols of the Border Patrol. You see, we have roving patrols in Tucson, Casa Grande, they can literally patrol anywhere in the 100 mile zone or even further, and they're collaborating like in Arizona, as most people here know, and most places, but even more so here in Arizona with the police. So you have this idea of a thickening of the border, of the border reality, creating like, so this, where we sit right now, we're in this constitution free zone, right? They could pull you over, they could look at you and say, whoa, you look like a national security threat to me.
So it's like this is a military occupation, this whole trip.
There's a lot of people who say that, yeah. Which is enough. Yes?
We have the militarization of the police force too, generally in the country.
That's another interesting thing, bringing up Jeff Halper in this book. He says that when you're talking about today's warfare, it's like really, to frame it as state versus state is no longer correct. It's like there's a militarization of the police, and there's a policization of the military. Is that a word? But that's a sort of, like it's a war against the people, right? Instead of the state versus state.
In your research, do you address all this issue? I apologize. I'm curious because that's a huge
issue. Yeah. And so in the my previous book, no, I didn't even look hardly at all. I'm sorry. Do I address the BDS movement in my book? And probably in my future book, yes. But I haven't done it yet, right? But I almost absolutely will in the future book. But my previous work, I haven't as much. But especially now, since taking this trip and being really involved with the Southern Arizona BDS movement and that sort of thing, yeah, it'll definitely be something I look into a lot more. Yes.
Is any of this going on the coastal areas or across the northern border?
Yes. The northern. So is any of this going along our coastal areas or on the northern border? And the answer is absolutely yes, it is. And you look at the northern border, we've gone from 400 to about 3,000 Border Patrol agents. The kind of collaboration that Border Patrol is doing with the police in the northern border is significant. The New York State troopers in the state of New York, right? Not Arizona, state of New York, are putting up checkpoints in areas like Wayne County. Wayne County is near Rochester, New York. It's right on Lake Ontario, so it's a border area, right? It's in the 100 mile zone. But who goes there? Farm workers, 8,000 a year. There's lots of apple orchards. There's a Mott's applesauce factory there. So what happens is, so then New York State troopers, one thing that they've done is set up a checkpoint in front of the laundromat in a little place called Sodus, New York, on Sundays, right, the only day off. So when people would do their laundry, right? So people go to do their laundry, and they get, and guess, there's three state troopers, and then guess who? A green striped border patrol car, like you'd see roaming around here, there as well. So if they were to suspect you don't have documents, they transfer you to the border patrol, and the similar system for here happens there. And that's, you know, that's going on. It's not nearly as much as it is here,
yeah,
but it's going on in more extensive ways in New York. Like Patrick Leahy, the senior senator from Vermont, the story where he was traveling and he got a border patrol checkpoint. He says it was 125 miles, so it was past the 100 mile zone in the state of New York. He was pulled out. He asked the border patrol agent, "Why are you pulling me out of my? Why are you asking me to get out of my car?" And the border patrol agent pointed at his gun and said, "That's the only authority I need."
Yeah. Wow. Oh my.
And you're seeing it more and more on the coasts as well. You're seeing it a lot in Florida. Florida has like six border patrol stations. You're seeing it up the coast of California. But, yes.
Well, the BTS movement seems like it's the only weapon against all these very difficult areas out. And it's being attacked everywhere. Universities. Can you talk about what's happening to the attacks on it here in Arizona?
I don't know if I'd be able to. I don't know if Sarah would.
I didn't get the question.
To talk about the attacks on BTS here in Southern Arizona.
Universities. Any laws being passed like in New York?
Well, there has been a state legislative effort. So one of the things is that the state of Arizona, the legislature, has passed a law basically saying that any company that follows BDS, doesn't do business with companies that are involved in Israeli occupation and Israeli militarization will not get contracts with the state of Arizona. So basically, did I say that right?
And that happened in California.
Arizona is not the only state, but that's one of the main things. And we protested that some, but it still went through. One of the things we are working on here locally is to try to stop the G4S contract that the city of Tucson has to provide security on lots of city on the city. All over the city, different properties, but on the streetcar and the zoo and many different parts of the city government. So and that's coming due next month. So we're hoping that we now have enough momentum to try to stop that, because they've been stopped in Durham and a couple of other cities. And Denver. Denver also has ended their contract with G4S.
Do you have the proposition number?
The proposition number? For what?
Is there a vote to take place?
No. They already passed. The governor signed it. And the governor signed it. So it's law in Arizona until it gets repealed.
How about
actually
students and college professors?
Dave would be able to speak better to that. No, I think it's been pretty difficult to get to get the university to boycott, let's say, the University of Arizona divest. That's my understanding, but I don't know that much about it. I don't know if anyone else here wants to address that specifically.
I had a quick question. So related to, you've been speaking a lot about like the exchange of ideas and technologies around borders within like Israel and then the U.S.
Yeah.
Has your research taken you into like Pan de Punta del Sur? Like, could you get into that a little bit or speak a little on that?
Yeah. So the question is, has my research been looking at Israel and the borders, and has it taken me to Plan Frontera Sur, which is the Mexico border plan that started in 2014? And my answer is yes. I have looked in quite a bit to that kind of bolstering of the Mexico, primarily the Mexico-Guatemala border, which is actually, I'm working on a project that's looking at following US DHS money or DOD money abroad and looking at how it manifests in different border areas. And one of the biggest examples right now is Mexico, southern Mexico. Their southern border plan, where you just see a significant bolstering with lots of resources, millions of dollars of resources coming from the United States through a package called the Merida Initiative. Through the third pillar of the Merida Initiative, which is called the 21st Century Border. So if that sounds Orwellian to you, it sounds Orwellian to me. And what I've seen is that it's become very difficult for people to cross that border. There's for example, going north from like Tapachula to into the interior of Mexico, you have to go through, I've counted, always over 10 checkpoints, usually immigration checkpoints, but sometimes military. What they're doing is also a layered border policing, like the United States. They call them enforcement bands. So one of them is the checkpoints. Another is like these gigantic immigration areas. They have roving patrols, and it goes much further than the 100 miles. Like you can find like immigration checkpoints 200 miles inland in Mexico. So you get a lot of people in similar, I would even argue it's similar strategy that you see on the US-Mexico border, because everyone here is aware that we have a prevention through deterrence strategy, right? Where all the kind of traditional crossing places are blocked off, so people end up walking very, very long distances without having enough water, with enough food, and suffering greatly, and many, you know, a lot of people have died crossing, right? In Mexico, in southern Mexico, you're seeing a similar phenomenon of people walking hundreds of miles through very vulnerable areas for example, from Tapachula to Arriaga, which is 150 miles inland, people will walk all the way to Arriaga before, when they could get a train, and they get a hop on the train there. So I've looked into it. I mean, that's it in a nutshell, but what I've looked into following the kind of bolstering of U.S. has supported Mexico border building for a long time, but there's been an upsurge of it in the last 2 years. Yes?
What about Mexico supporting U.S.?
Pardon me?
In terms of money, all of the knowledge that you're talking about, is it funded also more like from the Mexican government or corporations in Mexico?
Mexico's, there's a lot of technologies and stuff coming for the U.S., but also Mexico's very involved in its border building. I don't know about, like...
Do you think it's more the states investing there than Mexico?
I think in terms of Mexico, I think there's a certain percentage that's the states, but it's a much bigger percentage of Mexico, according to that plan, that they're putting into their border. How much of that is being, given to contracts to private companies? I'm not sure.
I mean, I'm just thinking of in the future.
Yeah.
About this wall.
Yeah.
How much is already happening? I'm just saying.
You could definitely say, like, in Mexico, they're significantly upped it. They have like motion sensors they're putting in the rivers. Like the Suchiate River, they're putting like under, you know, they're putting in that sort of technology. I don't think they're going to build a wall, though. They're not going to build a wall. It's going to be like the kind of a zone where people can actually cross for about 5 miles, and then all of a sudden the checkpoints and the heavy patrolling. At least that's what it's been up to this point. I guess they could possibly build a wall. I've seen like WikiLeaks stuff from U.S. embassy cables saying, what's going on in Mexico? Everyone's crossing. You know, if anyone's been to the southern border in Mexico, you know, people, you can cross on a raft, right, pretty easily. And you see these U.S. embassy, kind of alarmed U.S. embassy cables saying, what's going on? They need to build a wall. But I don't think Mexico's gonna build a wall. And for that matter, Central America is beginning to start its border task forces. I interviewed somebody in Guatemala, in Zacapa, Guatemala, a commander. I got to the military base, and I was like 2 hours late, And I said, and I actually went to the wrong place. But I said, you know, they looked at me and said, I said, I want to interview them about the border stuff, border, the border task force. And they asked me, are you from BORTAC? Right? And I was like, so nobody in the United States knows who BORTAC is. So there's a random, kind of a random soldier. And BORTAC, of course, is like the special forces unit of the U.S. Border Patrol. BORTAC is the training unit that goes abroad and does trainings all over the world.
Wow.
So this soldier just said, ask me, right? I'm like, they're BORTAC are like robo, kind of robo cops. You know, I actually was really late and I was coming from San Pedro Sula and I miscalculated everything and the border crossing and everything. And I got there really late and rolled out of this taxi and he's like, are you from BORTAC? But I ended up getting like learning that how involved the U.S. is, you know, is very much from the U.S. Embassy and U.S. training, and BORTAC agents stayed there and they trained the Guatemalan border guards. And it goes on and on. Honduras, I interviewed people in Honduras, El Salvador. It goes on and on and on. Yes?
In terms of the perverse proposal to have Mexico pay for the wall, there's already the proposal that the remesas that are sent by people earning in the States back to families be cut off to pay for the wall.
Yeah, that's the Trump. Yeah, that's, I'm very, very unlikely that we'll see that happen. One thing I would say is that Mexico, with lots of U.S. pressure, is doing the southern border stuff. So you can make the case that Mexico's already building the wall for the United States, but not on the northern border, on its southern border. Yes? Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, what does the technology work? The Boeing stuff they say didn't work. Does the Elbit system stuff, well, it passed, so does it work? Do they want it to work? You know?
I don't think they do, but like, they tell you that they do.
No, they say that the Elbit system passed the pilot test, so it quote unquote works, right? Or, I mean, I imagine the radar works, the cameras. Pardon?
They gotta change their apprehension numbers. I know that internally they meant to be obviously, but on the border, are they actually
apprehending? Well, the apprehension numbers have gone way down, right? And then they've gone up a little bit in the last couple of years. That the apprehension numbers are the worst possible metric ever. You know, like if like people are undocumented, right? That means they're not being counted, right? And the very fact of the matter is that people like avoid border patrol. So it's like, so, I mean, I know you can deduce some things by apprehension level, especially significant drops, but it's like almost the worst possible metric, right? And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anybody else has an answer to that question, but I would say that the new technology, since they went through the cancellation and it passed the test, it works better than before. I bet it also is geared to be upgraded because, you know, if you're looking in a complex, like an industrial complex, you definitely want to have a situation where you're constantly building upon it. So I would imagine there's room for improvement always, you know, at the same time.
They got bonuses, right?
Did they?
Massive bonuses. Even though they didn't the FBI.
Yeah. Yes, and then you.
There's a very fine film that shows both the ethical and the technological advantages, if you want, of these drones, Spy in the Sky with Helen Mirren. It shows both what they amazingly can do, at the same time, shows some of the ethical problems.
Thanks. Thank you for the recommendation. Matt? That's the thing about, so the numbers, they go down. Oh, everything's working. All this buildup is working, right? So we need more of it, right? The numbers are up. Oh my God, we need more of the buildup, right? Because the numbers are up. So the numbers game is used in either way. Pardon? Well, I mean, it's there's a number of tributaries, right? I mean, one obvious huge actor now is private industry and the private sector. And the fact that that's not in any sort of debate about immigration, that people are making money off this, is ridiculous, because you have to have this, there is a powerful interest involved. And to have that in the debate is so imperative, and it's not there. I'm not saying that it's the only thing. There's lots of, you know, there's xenophobia of the, you know, there's, it's you know, every time you see a wall, you should think racism, right? The control of people, the you know, the exclusion. It's a system of exclusion, right? And when you, like, coming from Israel right now and seeing this, the kind of system of control in place there, it's even like you start to think of words like apartheid, like who's included and who's not, who's allowed access, who's not, who's allowed to cross lines, who's not, who's allowed to fly across the world, and who can't even cross their own street, you know. And so all those things have to be considered. Yes, well, I'll get you.
Jeff Palfer recently presented his book in our area, and one of the things that he said about the industry in Israel is that they will sell it to anybody. That they make no
So Israel will sell their technologies to anybody, and that it doesn't. I don't know that, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it's like any company wants to sell their products, right? So I imagine Israel or the United States or companies from anywhere will sell their products to anyone to make money, right? Anyone who has the money, yes. Oh, then you. Within climate change, climate change is something that we got to be more. So when you look at climate change, I'll just try to answer this as quickly as possible. That's why I'm stumbling here. If you see the projections for climate change, all the projections for people displaced by climate change are staggering numbers. Like they're saying we're going to see people on the move in the next 20 to 30 by 2050, more than we ever have seen in human history. The numbers range from, you know, 200 million to a billion. I've seen as high as a billion. What the final number is, I do not know, but the predictions are there. Whether those predictions are true or not, I don't know, but like look at Haiti right now, right? And the Hurricane Matthew that just hit Haiti, or any number of different examples. The idea of people being displaced, like last year, 2015, I think there was 19 million people that were displaced by disasters. And many of those disasters can be attached to climate change. Guess who also knows this? Department of Homeland Security. They have a climate adaptation plan. They are anticipating increased immigration in the future. There's contingency plans, there's mass migration plans. They're predicting that islands are gonna sink in the Caribbean. Central America is one of the most vulnerable places to climate change in the world. Honduras is number one over the Philippines. As far as climate disasters in the last 25 years. So this kind of anticipation of people being displaced and on the move is very much in the minds of Homeland Security. So when you think in Washington there's a debate, well, not really. I mean, there is in Congress, but not in the military. The Department of Defense, Pentagon, and Department of Homeland Security are preparing for that future. And so now I would suggest when you look at a border wall, that's part of the story of that border wall.
Yeah, I'm just curious, since you said that a lot of the tech companies in Israel are supported by the government, if anybody's tracking or if there's a way to know how much of the money that the U.S. gives Israel in foreign aid is going to develop the very technologies that we're then importing from them. Is anybody...
So the question is, how much money from the U.S. military aid to Israel is going to these development of companies in Israel? That's a good question. I think like 25% of the military aid package went to Israeli companies. I think that changes, though, with the $38 billion that the Obama administration just...
That's why Elbit's coming here.
That's why Elbit's coming here, right? So that's... So, yeah, but there's a good organization in Israel called Who Profits. I bet you Who Profits, if you look, I think it's whoprofits.org, or I could get you the information if you give me. Who Profits is a really good, it follows a lot of the money, and maybe somebody here knows too. But.
Do you get all this research information via the Freedom of Information Act? Is that
how you're do I get this information from the Freedom of Information Act?
By using it.
Some of it's just out there. Like the climate change stuff, you'd be amazed. You like look and all of a sudden, oh, there's a climate adaptation plan. Oh, they're saying there's gonna be mass immigration coming. Oh, they're saying we have to prepare our borders for that. Oh, you know, so all of a sudden, you know, that's another tributary. And it's right out there. It's not like a report that's being the media, you know, writing anything about, but if you start looking in DHS archives, there it is, right? And so there's a lot of stuff that's just there, right? But some of the stuff needs to be FOIA'd, and that is a process and a half.
Oh, yeah.
Have you done it before?
No, I haven't. 5 minutes,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes?
When you were talking earlier about VORTEC in the Northern Triangle companies and other countries and other stuff, we're just talking about vulnerabilities. Is that part of the Alliance for Progress, or is there marriage there?
Yeah, the Central American stuff a part of the Alliance for, I think it's Prosperity? Alliance for Prosperity. Yeah. So anyone who wants to like look at borders in Central America, they should look at this Alliance for Prosperity package, and it's and CARSI, the Central American Regional Security Initiative. CARSI, the Central American Regional Security Initiative, has looked at borders and say there's border deficiencies in Central America and they need to build up their borders. So that's, so in Alliance for Prosperity is this idea that, you know, we have to build up, basically protecting neoliberal economic model, right? Protecting the mines, protecting all these like big companies, mega projects that are really displacing people. And that's, yeah, it's all attached. Anybody else? Yes.
I lived on the northern border of Syria, about 100 kilometers from Afrin, in Turkey, and I just was wondering if you could speak a little bit to the way the Syrian refugee crisis has completely changed the game in terms of border politics, from the breakdown of the Eurozone and the rise of the fascist right in Europe, and the National Front gaining strength in numbers like never before. Things like this are changing.
I can give it a shot. You know? Awesome. You're probably more knowledgeable than me, but I'll give it a shot. And the Syrian, you know, I was just there. I was on the Jordanian side, looking into Syria from that angle. I didn't go into Syria, unfortunately. I did talk to some Syrian folks that had crossed the border and were in Jordan. But geez, I mean, I was in Paris last year. Went like 3 days after those attacks in November, and just watching everything unfold so rapid fire. And so I actually went to a thing called Milipol. Milipol is like the number one homeland security conference in the world. It's like so gigantic. There's so many like surveillance. I mean, it's so many companies. It's unbelievable. You should go. I don't know, you just keep walking. It's a mall, it's an endless mall of surveillance. And I went to Milipol in Paris 3 days after the Paris attacks. And I was kind of floored by how quickly those attacks, right? And that was when 129 people were killed in coordinated attacks in Paris in November. How quickly those attacks were used by the private companies and then connected to the refugees. There was one of them that came across the border from Syria, and the idea that the Syrian refugees, and then how that narrative was then used to try to sell the surveillance products at this Homeland Security Convention. It was just like, it was like this that quick. Even in the power, even in the PowerPoints, I go to companies' PowerPoints, and it was. Oh yeah, and just I went. It, that's my example to give. But it, yeah, it's significant, and I'd like to talk to you sometime about that.
We have a couple of representatives here from the Tohono O'odham Hemingway Rights Network, and I just want to ask folks if you have any questions for them specifically.
We just have 2 minutes left.
We have 2 minutes left, and that's Nellie David and Josh.
We have a presentation also just following this one.
Okay, so well,
you can have that time.
Announce that. Okay. Well, then we'll
hesitate. And also, when wrapping up, we'll have still a brief time. But, you know, you have the flyer that Sarah has sent around. If anybody would like to get involved with BBS, it's really important that we learn and then we take action. And if anybody is interested in Jewish Voice for Peace, you can email me at tucson@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. And we welcome all people, non-Jews, and if you're in other areas, there are JVP chapters. So, you know, just is there one last brief question for Todd, Jim?
I'd like to ask Native Americans here, what is the attitude of the Tohono O'odham about a fence along their property or their So, if I could, I'm not saying that will happen, but I think the question that a lot of people will raise who won't come to a gathering and may not really understand, you know, the economics of it. So we're, you know, we're under siege with all these attacks, etc. And you know, there are a lot of irrational fears. That's not necessarily one of them. So what do we really say to somebody who, you know, has poured into a culture of fear rather than trying to get above it?
I mean, that's a great question. I have my answer, or one answer. There's probably lots of answers. One thing that I like to say is, what is security really? Like, if I'm in Flint, Michigan, and I'm drinking contaminated water and my children are getting sick, is that not security? If I'm going to get, my house is getting foreclosed, the roof over my head, isn't that security? And then people are telling me that I have to worry about somebody over a line, and usually that somebody's, you know, might be in even a more dire predicament than me. And so, you know, this idea that how is if we look at the whole pie graph of how money is being spent just in the United States, like, can we holistically talk about that? Can we have a good conversation? Like, should money be, like, what is security? Should money be spent over here, over there? You know, that's my short answer. That's one of many probably.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Hey, what's up? I didn't even see y'all there.
Pretty good.